Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 3 of our Ashes series. In episode 1, we tried to make cricket make a little more sense. In episode 2, we took you back to where it all began and explained why this rivalry burns the way it does. And now, in episode 3, we're turning to something a bit more personal. Why we love the Ashes, who made us fall in love with it, and where those players sit within our own pantheon. So you ready? Let's go.
Nasser, you've won the toss. What are you going to do this morning?
We're going to have a ball.
Oh, ball in! First ball! The in-swinger from Stark! Immediate breakthrough!
That is very good.
He's just spooned it over the keeper. It's a deliberate stroke.
And such Gilchrist a good run, that, actually. And that could be out! A direct hit from Flintoff. Pontic was his shortest.
This time it's past Stokes. It's on its way to the boundary. The ball makes contact with that boundary rope. Steve Smith celebrates a double hundred at the moment.
Getting has absolutely no idea what has happened to it. Still doesn't know.
In gets it back to the ending. He gets the ending that he wants. 604 and final test wicket for Stuart Broad. What a magnificent cricket.
This is the Sporting Almanac Podcast. Rocking and rolling.
Oh, good morning, mate.
Good morning, Ben. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Are you, how optimistic are you feeling?
For the Gabba, for the Gabatoire, for the tests that good England teams regularly lose. How am I feeling about this current England team going into this?
In a pink ball test, Australia never lose.
Australia are dominant at and England never win. How am I feeling, Ben? Well, sport is weird.
Sport is weird. Masterclass incoming. Win inside 2 days.
Yeah.
Didn't say which team.
Yeah. It's definitely not going 5 days, is it?
Well, look, can it be worse than getting beat 73-0 at home in the final test match of the autumn internationals like Wales did to South Africa?
I feel bad for Wales because they were showing... I mean, they've had a really bad couple of years. Obviously, anyone who follows rugby union will know that. They were showing glimpses of promise. They've obviously got Rhys Zammit's come back into the mix. That's a cause for optimism. They've, you know, won the odd game, albeit against borderline tier two nations. That was a bad way to end your summer, or end your autumn, sorry.
A record defeat for Wales. I think that's the first time they've been blanked at home for 30 years, and it's the most points they've ever conceded at home. So, yeah, not ideal preparation for the Six Nations for them, but...
No, they'll just be hoping for... I think if they come fifth, they'll be happy in the Six Nations. If they can beat Italy to the wooden spoon,
yeah,
I think they'll be delighted.
The only way is up. Let's say that.
Indeed.
Flamengo.
Yeah.
Winning the Copa de Libertadores against Palmeiras. 1-0.
Very good.
Danilo with the winner, of all people.
Oh, yeah. Fair enough.
Blast from the past.
Competition we'll probably do next year, I think. I was just talking about that. No Ashes next year, so give that a go.
That'll definitely be on the agenda. First Brazilian side to win it 4 times, apparently. I didn't know that. But those two have dominated that tournament, so I'm sure we'll get into the meat and drink of it, as you say, when we talk about
the nitty-gritty, yeah.
In a meaningful sense. North Melbourne Kangaroos beating Brisbane Lions in the women's AFL final yesterday. Was it yesterday? No, it would have been 5 days ago.
When are we recording this? Who knows?
And then, yeah, the FIA and Formula One get what they want. And the race goes to the final weekend in Abu Dhabi. So,
yeah, still a bit of excitement left in there. But, yeah.
Yeah, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking, as we said, about the Gabba. Test 2.
The Gabatois.
Pink ball test. Hopefully, we don't have a repeat of NASA's nightmare from 2001-2002. First test, so it would have been in 2001. Oh.
2002-2003.
Is it 2002-2003? Well, yeah. Whatever it was, Wisden called it one of the costliest decisions in test history.
It's a decision which is haunting him to this very day. Still gets mentioned during commentary, which NASA is saying, of course, is a regular part of.
Yeah. Winning the toss, choosing to bat. And yeah, well, we had a bad day, basically. I think Australia ended up getting something like... I mean, their first innings total was 492, but on day one they were 364 for two, ponting 123 before Ashley Giles picked up a consolation, and Matthew Hayden 186 red. And then we dropped a heap of catches. Oh god. And then I think Simon Jones, that was the game where he do you remember when he slid for the ball in the outfield and he ruptured his cruciate ligament?
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Which to be fair, added to the drama in the story of 2005.
Sure, but his ACL exploded.
Dominance there. Yeah, don't get me wrong, I'm not sure he'd have written it that way himself, but it made 2005 an even better story than it was.
For sure. But yeah, I mean, that test, I think we made 325 in reply, which shows you that it was definitely a good pitch to bat early on. It ended, though, with us getting skittled for 79 in the fourth innings and losing by 384 runs. So hopefully tonight doesn't go like that, but we'll see.
Yeah.
What's the plan for this episode?
So we're going to bridge the gap a little bit. We're going to bring it from Richie Benno to the modern day. But the bulk of this episode is going to be us talking about why we love the Ashes so much and why we love cricket through the prism of the participants, the players that played, that we fell in love with, that we hated, that brought emotions out of us at times. Because, Test cricket and the Ashes especially, it makes you emotional.
And we're going to do it through the lens of the selector.
Indeed, yeah. So we're going to, based on the time we've been watching the game, so essentially the last 30 years, we're going to pick our combined Ashes 11. We're going to debate it. We might not agree with everything. I'm sure there's some we will agree with. And we're going to start it with a toss of a coin to decide who is making first pick. So yeah.
Who's batting or bowling? Are we picking from 1 to 11 or are we picking from 11 to 1? That's the aim of the game. But you're going to start us off by bridging that gap, I think.
I am, yeah. So, there's one series. We're going to be pretty quick on this. We're going to talk about one series and one match in particular that just needs a mention in the interim period between the 1960s, 70s, when we left it off, and the modern era. And that, of course, to any English cricket fans will probably guess, that is 1981, specifically the third test of the 1981 series at Headingley. So, set the scene for 1981. It was meant to go England's way. They'd won the last two Ashes series, combined 8-1 on aggregate, albeit 1978-79 was a lighter than usual Australian team because of Kerry Packer's breakaway series and all the nonsense that was going on around that. So a slightly weaker Australian team, but nevertheless, 5-1 England win. Can't say that wasn't coming. 1981 series, Ian Botham was now England's captain. Now, Ian Botham at the time was only 25 years old, I think 25, 26 years old. He was already England's... probably the best player, certainly the most popular player. He's an all-rounder, good with the bat, good with the ball, could be a very explosive bowler and a very hard-hitting batter who excelled in both the long and short forms of the game.
Bit of an icon.
An icon, absolutely an icon, and love him or hate him nowadays because he's a very opinionated old man nowadays with some opinions that a lot of people might not agree with, but certainly, certainly an icon. So he'd taken over the captaincy from a man named Mike Brearley. And I've mentioned Mike Brearley already, and I love Mike Brearley. Yeah. Mike Brearley is, in my opinion, and a lot of people's opinion, the best England captain ever. You can point out how good he was as a captain by pointing out how bad he was as a batter, because he was in the team as a batsman. But he only averaged 22 throughout his test career. But he stayed in the team because he was such a good captain. He was described as a leader of men, as a man who was a master in the art of humanity, basically, of psychology. In fact, he was a Cambridge graduate who is a psychoanalyst and a psychotherapist as well. Nowadays, he may well be retired now, but Cambridge graduate, played for the Cambridge team. But he had been stripped of the captaincy in 1980. It had been passed on to Ian Botham. And since that point, Ian Botham's stellar test career had taken a nosedive. The pressure of captaincy had got to him. He wasn't scoring runs with the bat. He wasn't taking as many wickets with the ball. And the 1981 Ashes series started off in a similar vein to that. England lost the first test. It was Dennis Lilly who ripped them apart in that. He got player good. Of the match.
Quite good.
Quite a master of tearing through English lineups. But
355 test wickets across a 13-year career. 26 on the all-time list.
It's definitely worth a mention because we are going to unfortunately skip over quite a few players from the 70s and 80s who probably do deserve a mention today, but unfortunately we weren't alive to see them play, so maybe in a future episode we'll go back and do them. But England, Australia won by 4 wickets at Trent Bridge in the first test. The second test was at Lords and that was drawn, so England were under pressure in the third test. The second test was particularly notable for Ian Botham's performance in it, or lack of performance. He got a pair. For those who don't know, that means he got 0 in both innings.
For those who don't know, it's what Zach Crawley got in the first test.
Yeah. So, Botham got a free ball duck in the first innings and then a golden duck, as in he was out first ball, in the second innings. So Botham immediately after the game resigned the captaincy, which according to Wisden's Matthew Engel was a minute before being sacked. So got his note in quickly enough.
Jump before he was pushed.
Indeed. His form was absolutely shot to pieces. It was the right decision. And England selectors then did make a sensible decision, unlike their decision to give him the captaincy in the first place, which was insane because it was right before England went on tour to the West Indies as well. And for anyone who knows cricket in the 1980s, not a pleasant place to go. England actually had back-to-back series against the West Indies and they lost both of them without winning a test match. So England found themselves 1-0 down the series. Mike Brearley had been restored to the team as captain, which was a good idea because he was an expert in the art of captaincy, of course. It was at a time when cricket was sort of struggling for national attention a bit. Football was in a pretty dark era for football, as we've discussed previously.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that's true.
But it was stealing a lot of the headlines as a result. So cricket was sort of falling behind. And the match started badly for England, shall we say. So as we mentioned in the first episode, if you do not get within 200 runs of your opponent's score from the first innings, they can make you bat again. And England finished their first innings, bowled all out, 227 runs behind Australia. So effectively, they were dead. The game was over at this point. Like, no one ever wins after being asked to follow on. In the second innings, it wasn't going much better. They were still 92 runs behind with 7 wickets down in what was an absolutely hopeless situation. Famously, there was an electronic scoreboard which displayed the odds from Ladbrokes for England to win the game, which was 500-1. So you could have made an absolute killing out of this because guess what happens next, Ben?
Ian Botham happens next.
Ian Botham happens next. So 2,000 fans turned up on the Monday morning at Headingley. Obviously, it's a work day. People aren't going to take time off. It was drizzly as well. It was classic Leeds weather. It felt like the last rite of English cricket at this point. Ian Botham arrived at Headingley having gone 21 innings without a 50. He'd taken 6 wickets in the first innings, so he was already on a bit of an upper in those regards, but England obviously were miles behind. England was so pessimistic about their chances in this, they checked out of their hotel that were booked in for the Monday evening, assuming the game was going to be over by this point. Botham had walked out 105-5. Initially, he played quite quietly with Geoffrey Boycott still in. Geoffrey Boycott, obviously, quite a slow, meticulous player. Trying to keep in, just building a few runs before Boycott was dismissed. And at that point, things turned around. And this is something that was described by Matthew Engel, who I mentioned before, from Wisden. Graham Dilley came in at number 9, and that unlocked Botham's, and I'm quoting here, "oh fuck it" mode.
Sounds appropriate. It sounds about right, yeah. Really, as well.
Botham just starts swinging his back. Both of them actually started swinging the back, and they launched basically an assault on the Australian bowling. Botham's stroke making, he had a lot of luck. He got away with a couple of things, but raw power as well. Dilley as well, and then Alden Willis as well, joined the mayhem towards the end. It's the kind of situation you could replay it 1,000 times and England will probably lose it 1,000 times, but on that day it all fell into place. Botham finished 149 not out.
Yeah, red, baby.
But
of 148 balls, wasn't it?
Australia still needed, 130-odd runs to win. So they were still favourites. But Rise Up One, Bob Willis, another legend of English cricket. A curly-haired, tall, lanky, fast bowler. He was getting towards the end of his career, creaking knees, but he summoned up a spell of legendary bowling. 8 for 43, so 8 wickets for 43 runs. He tore through Australia like Conan the Barbarian in a bad mood. That's another quote. And Australia collapsed and England won by 18 runs. So the game itself wasn't a great test. Like, generally, there was a lot of bad cricket played in it. Some of it was quite dreary, but it brought cricket back into the nation's folklore. It turned the series around as well. England ended up winning the series, retaining the Ashes at that point. And it sparked a boom in popularity of English cricket. It made stars of, obviously, Ian Botham was already a star, but David Gower as well, Mike Gatting, Bob Willis, obviously. Botham more than anyone. Obviously, he's a charismatic dude, as we mentioned. His sort of aura defined that era. And
Gatting was in that team as well, was he? Did you say
Gatting? Yeah, Mike Gatting was at the start of his career, yeah.
Yeah.
That might lead you on to something, but it was a consequential test, I say. It turned around the popularity of English cricket more than anything, and is obviously still looked back on today very, very fondly. So yeah, that's Mione.
Botham's Ashes.
Bridge the gap. Botham's Ashes indeed, yeah.
Apparently he hates Ian Chappell as well. They hate each other.
So why does he hate Ian Chappell?
They had a falling out when Botham was in Australia playing, I don't know if he's playing grade cricket or like club cricket or something. Anyway, I'm not sure, but they had a falling out in a bar and then just like literally like both held grudges and have never made up. Yeah, they just had like a bar tiff.
Fair enough.
But yeah, it's just quite funny because I think loads of people have tried to get them to make up and they just haven't. And then they like confronted each other in a car park at the Adelaide Oval. And yeah, all very silly, silly playground stuff. But there we are.
Big egos at play there, I suspect.
Yeah, I suspect so. And I think Ian Chappell lost quite a lot to England in the Ashes, which probably didn't help because Australians are famously good at losing.
Yes. Well, the English are used to it, you see.
Yeah, exactly. We're professionals. certainly in this contest, at least. But no, that's a cool story. Botham's Ashes. Who doesn't know about them, really? One of the sort of most iconic series of all time, put simply. And it was kind of the end of an era of dominance for England.
England won a couple more.
And then it
turned. A couple more Ashes series until 1987. From 1989 onwards, that's when the tides turned. And
that's it.
This is where we sort of, you meet the real protagonists of this episode, me and you. Because we came into the end of this sort of 1998-99 sort of time, for me anyway, I'm probably earlier for you, came into this mindset that England just can't win the Ashes because it had been a decade, best part of a decade at this point. It continued for another half decade afterwards.
Let's put this into real context for people, Jack. We were 17 years of age when England first won a series.
We were.
Like,
well, technically, we were 1 year of age when England first won a series. It was just after that. Oh, no, wait. Did England win 89?
No.
No, England lost. England got smashed in 89. Sorry, 1987 was... You are correct. We were 17 years of age when England first won Ashes series.
We didn't know an England victory in the Ashes. So...
I remember the furore and the like celebrations around simply just winning a test match in 2001, because we were already 3-0 down, I think, at that point. And then Mark Butcher, obviously that magnificent, really good 173 to win us that test match, and everyone was like celebrating. But as Nasser Hussain put it, we used to lose the first few games and then pip one off them when they were drunk and having celebrated so hard. That's all we did.
It's mad. I think the period of Australian dominance that you and I were born into is the most dominant period that anyone's had in the Ashes since basically in the modern, like definitely in the modern era, and probably since since it started, like 1882, when England won about 8 or 9 of them in a row. And then this Australian dominance in the 90s was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 Ashes series in a row, in which England won 7 tests.
Of which 4 of those were dead rubbers.
Yeah.
Only 3 of those, I think. I might be wrong. It might be 3 or 4, but we had any chance of still winning the series when we won the matches. The rest were just dead rubbers at the end.
So if there's any debate as to who the best Ashes team is in history, it's the Australian Ashes side of the 1990s.
Late 90s, early 2000s, yeah.
Yeah, into the early 2000s for sure.
We'll be talking about a few members of that team, I am sure.
Oh, yes. So should we start that exercise?
Indeed, unless you have anything else you want to say.
No, I let's just dive straight in. You're the home
Okey-doke.
Captain. You're going to toss the coin.
I guess I'm going to let you... I'm going to see if I can capture the flick of the coin on the audio. You're going to have to call in the air, Ben. Call in the air.
Tails.
It is heads.
Oh, what are you doing?
It is heads. I'm showing it to the camera.
Having a bat or a bowl.
See, I'm a traditionalist, Ben. And traditionally, batting first is the answer. But then, you know, people have made that mistake before. But then people have made the mistake before, like NASA, by not batting first. So I'm going to have a bat, Ben. I'm going to have a bat.
Have a bat. No worries. So you're opening the batting, and you're deciding, or you're at least nominating the first batsman. Position number one. Who's facing your first ball?
Then? Who's facing my first ball? So we're coming up to Christmas, Ben. Christmas is a magical time.
It is.
Because it was, of course, the time of the birth of our Lord and Saviour, mm-hmm. Sir Alastair Cook.
Yes.
Born on 25th of December 1984 in Gloucester. And obviously a left-handed opening batter. He defined English cricket for so long. Obviously, captain for many, many years. Had some incredible series, both in England and in Australia during the Ashes. Mm-hmm. His Test career, 161 matches, 12,472 runs at 45.35. 33 hundreds in that all-time, England's all-time leading Test run scorer until recently. Joe Root passed him. He played in 159 consecutive Test matches.
Which is mental.
Which is an all-time record, yeah. And he captained England in 59 of them. And 69 one-day internationals as well, which you could argue he had no right in being with his batting style. But nevertheless, England were a very different
times.
One-day team at that time.
Pre-Owen Morgan, I'm sure.
Yeah, so he was a master of technique, patience, repeatable methods. He was very, very set in his ways, in his approach. He would always practice the same shots, go through the same routines before facing balls, before coming out to the crease. He was kind of anti-Bazball, really, I suppose. Would mm-hmm. he fit in the current team? Or would we even approach the game in the same way if we had an opening batter like Sir Alastair Cook?
Well, we could do with someone like him.
England, it's amazing to think how many openers England have got through in our time watching them, considering how set it was Strauss and Cook for so many years, how fortunate we were to have them, both of whom were very, very good batsmen. Yeah, and in terms of personality, he was a quiet guy, he was a modest guy, slightly awkward, you could almost say, Alistair, but charming as well.
Yeah, very charming. You can see why he was a good leader, actually. Lead by example rather than by sort of shouting and screaming and geeing people up. But if for what it's worth, mate, I think this is no debate. I think he is the number one on your team sheet facing the first ball. Although, you know, when he batted with Strauss, I think Strauss used to face first ball. But I would have Alistair Cook there. Mate, 57 50s didn't get mentioned. All of his tons against Australia in the Ashes are all away from home.
Yeah.
If that doesn't tell you what you need to know about the man, I'm not sure what will. But started with 116 at the Wacker in 2006 when we got thumped. Can you look beyond 2010-11? 766 runs in a series.
Incredible. Series in Australia.
In Australia. Series defining double ton. First test of the tour. Like, he'd been out of form going into that series as well. Like, I think he's on record as genuinely having said he thought he might get dropped.
Yeah.
And he just sort of stripped it back.
Which is crazy to think.
Yeah.
I literally can't imagine a world in which England think they've got good enough openers to drop Alistair Cook.
That's it,
it blows
right?
my mind.
It like just... Yeah.
Which, again, maybe they didn't. Maybe it was all in his own mind. But
yeah, well, that's true. You never quite know. But he certainly wasn't scoring the runs that are associated with him now. Like, that series is insane. Obviously, we wouldn't have won it without him. We went back to Australia in 2017 and scored 244 not out at the MCG. Never scored a home ton in the Ashes, as you just said. But...
opposite of Joe Root.
Second on the all-time England list, the sixth overall, like sixth highest run getter in Test cricket as an opening batsman is wild. I think genuinely, that record is, I think he's the only opener apart from Sunil Gavaskar to get over 10,000 runs.
Which is very, very good company.
That's pretty good company. After him, I think you have to go down to, you know, was Hashim Amla really in it? Like, he probably batted three for South Africa. I think it's Graham Smith and Hayden and co.
Definitely Smith.
That are pushing him. Smith, like 25% less runs. But yeah, like, yeah, that record for an opening bat is mad. That's
incredible. Incredible longevity, incredible consistency. The one thing you could say, and I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit, his average in the Ashes was slightly lower. It was about 40. His average in the Ashes, which, don't get me wrong, is still pretty good for an opener, as well playing in unfamiliar conditions a lot of the time. And there are opening batsmen, Australians, obviously, who you could argue have a slightly better record, such as Matthew Hayden, 45, Justin Lango opened a lot, 50 batting average. But
yeah,
that 2010-2011 series, he was dominant. He was incredible. And for his, and I know this is an Ashes thing we're talking about, for his impact for the game, for the sport, for his captaincy and his leadership, it's a no-brainer.
It's a no-brainer. So number one on the team sheet for us, Alistair Cook. Number two.
Easy.
My go, is it?
Picking
his opening partner. Well, you've just mentioned two of the names that are in the conversation. My pitch is for Matthew Hayden.
I think it's fair. I think it's a close run thing between Hayden and Langer. I think Hayden was more
aggressive.
It was more aggressive and more the traditional opener. Mm-hmm. Langer did play three early in his career, sort of filled in as an opener. He did very well and put England to the sword as well. And he did well actually in 2005. Which obviously Australia lost. But yeah, I think it's hard to look past Hayden.
Has such a good record. I mean, he's right up there at the all-time scorers as well, 27th on the all-time list, 8,625 runs, an average of 50.73. How many tons he got? 30 tons? Yeah, 30 test match hundreds, 29 50s. Do you know who I can barely believe I'm saying this, but David Warner...
Yeah.
Is definitely worthy of mention. Because he's actually scored more runs than Hayden. He scored 161 more career runs, but he played 9 more tests than Hayden. And averaged 44.59 to Hayden's 50. Also, Warner against England struggled, whereas Hayden averaged 45 against England and has scored more Ashes tons than Warner. So I think it's probably a more legitimate debate is Hayden or Langer. I also really like Langer. Like, I think he's an interesting man to listen to.
He is. Obviously became Australia coach as well later and was a successful coach.
Yeah.
Winning a couple of Ashes series as coach.
Yeah. And very nearly winning in England, but for Benjamin Stokes.
Indeed, yeah.
So yeah, I would say I'm pretty settled on Hayden. I think that's a very good opening pair as well. Cook holding down one end, Hayden with the license to be aggressive at the other. If they both get their average, then you're looking at 95 for two. It's not bad.
I'm not sure. Matthew Hayden probably wouldn't appreciate me introducing Alistair Cook as our Lord and Saviour, because he, of course, is a deeply Christian man. It is worth a mention, whose faith has played a part in his career and has had a couple of close misses in terms of, I think he nearly drowned at one point early in his career. Managed to survive that and attributed, of course, that to his religion. So,
well, he didn't attribute it to 2010-2011 series and 700 odd runs.
Mm. Amen.
Number three, Jack, you have the honour.
We've got the honour of saying the name of the person that we both know is going to be number three.
Yeah, let's go. Let's hear it. This is going to be really awkward if it's not the same guy.
We're going to obviously pick a captain at the end of this, and there's a debate over whether or not this chap will be captain. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. We'll talk about that. But Ricky Ponting.
Yes.
At number three.
Ricky Ponting.
He's a man that for many years England fans love to hate, and I don't know what it is, but you read about this and you hear people talk about it, and then you think about it, internalize it, and think, yeah, this is exactly what happened. we loved him by the time we retired.
Oh, for sure.
Like,
yeah.
Like, the respect that sort of grew over time and the appreciation of his ability and his fight and his scrappiness and his sort of never say die attitude and sort of almost as being the perfect foil for that sort of banter as well. Earlier on, 2005 and 2009 particularly, famously run out by a subfielder in 2005 in Gary Pratt.
Yeah.
Decisively run out in 2009 as well by Andrew Flintoff in an iconic Ashes moment. I mean, around that, his numbers, obviously ridiculous. He made his test debut in 95. His test career, 168 matches, 13,378 runs, which is ludicrous.
Third overall.
51.85, 41 hundreds, high score of 257. His first Ashes series was 1987. He played until 2011. 35 Ashes tests. It's 2,476 Ashes runs I've got written down, whether or not that's true or not. Let me check my spreadsheet.
2,476, that's what I've got.
Nice.
At 44.
Yeah, 44, which is pretty good. Arguably, it's lower than his test career, so maybe he underachieved, relatively speaking. Top score of 196 in the Ashes. But beyond that, he was obviously Australia captain during a lot of dominant series. 5-0 win, 2007. Obviously, very, very... There were questions about his captaincy in terms of his sort of... whether or not his field choices were good and things like that.
I find this bizarre. I really do find this bizarre. But go on.
But the thing you can't argue about his style of leadership was he dragged that whole team in the same direction. He was a old school leader of men in terms of leading by example, never say die attitude. Yeah, I've got a lot of respect and a lot of time for Ricky Ponting.
He's a brilliant captain and the most successful captain in international cricket history across all formats, not in test matches. That honour goes to Steve Waugh, who I'm sure will get a mention at some point in this debate. But yeah, he won 220 out of his 324 matches in charge, 67% win rate, and he has the biggest haul of ICC trophies by a captain. Like, anyone who's like, oh, he weren't that good, or I've got questions about it, it's like, what? Yeah, all right. Like, that's like saying that Messi's right foot ain't that good. Like, it's just a stupid thing to say. Like, when it's compensated heavily by all the other attributes that the man possesses.
He encapsulated what Australia were. He was arrogant, like in the best possible way. He was cocky and confident and spiky and aggressive, and the team was the same as him. He was leading the team in that manner. This was a team who knew they were the best team in the world.
Yeah.
And played accordingly.
I mean, like you said, he didn't have a perfect Ashes record. He lost three Ashes, 2005, 2009 and 2011.
Which, but I think is a record. I don't think any Australian captain has lost more.
Yeah. But that's also testament to his longevity as captain, because there's probably not that many that have been captain for so many series. And also he came up against, you know, like an England side in 2005 that finally were in a position to actually compete and were like stacked with talent. And then, you know, 2009, 2011, England had a bit of a renaissance. That's like the Peterson era and people like that. So like, there's no shame in losing to that England team. It's not like he was captain in the 90s and lost a couple of series, do you know? Like when England died.
That would have been quite quite shameful.
Yeah. So, I mean, he is, top scored in the 2006, 2007 Ashes as well in the 5-0 home win. 576 runs. Like, Australia's most capped player was Steve Waugh on 168 tests, which is a mental number. 8 Ashes tons, 9 50s. He's got the third highest number of centuries in international cricket behind Sachin Tendulkar and Virat Kohli. Like, plus his captaincy. I mean, he's number 3. He's now a head coach, commentator.
Yeah.
Super engaging bloke to listen to. Highly, highly knowledgeable, as you might expect with someone that kind of
absolutely
career. Like, yeah, number 3. Number 3, no doubt.
Just imagine we put this team up against a bunch of Martians or whatever, and they finally break the opening pair of Cookie and Hayden, and all of a sudden they've got Punter walking to the crease. They're not going to be happy about it.
Definitely not. And like, he's a conventional three as well. That's what I thought was really interesting when I was sort of looking at this and trying to decide, because a lot of very good batsmen like to bat 4. Some even like to bat 5. He was a conventional 3.
I always like batting three. That was my favourite position to bat.
Could not bat, so...
Yes, you could.
Not very well.
Probably a better batsman than me, except for you in the firsts.
Not as well as
I peaked at the seconds.
But anyhow, we... us transitioning into our school cricketing heyday whilst picking an all-time Ashes 11 is quite humbling.
number four, Ben.
Number four. Steve Smith, mate. That's my case. I was going to make the case for Steve Waugh. I think Steve Waugh is extremely unlucky, unless you want him at five, and we can have that debate.
Well,
but he's extremely unlucky not to take the number four position. But it has to go to Steve Smith. The thing about Steve Smith is he's missed some prime years.
Yeah.
And his record is astonishing. And obviously he missed those prime years because of his, you know, like, I actually think it, like, can I just level with everyone here? I think that his ban was ridiculous. Like, actually ridiculous.
It was overly punitive.
Oh, so, so far over the top. It's insane. But yeah, best since Bradman. What can you say? Average is 60. 60 at number four, which is preposterous. Average is 55 against England. I mean, 55 is like a higher test average than most people achieve in their careers. And he's racking that up just against us. He's a modern day batting genius, mate. He's unorthodox.
He's very unorthodox. And he changed his batting style fairly early in his career. And
he used
it
to be
added
a leg
about 30 runs. Well, yeah, he started off as a leg spinning all rounder who could bat around 30. He changed his style. He adjusted his initial step and how he sort of approached it, stepping back, I think, a bit more to short pitch bowling, whatever, stuff like that. He added 30 runs to his average almost like overnight.
Yeah,
it's incredible. I remember it happening. I remember thinking, Steve Smith, the crap leggy. Like,
yeah.
How is this guy?
Who is now impossible to get out, it turns out.
Yeah.
I don't really know like how else to sum it up, really. He's top scored in 2015 with 508 runs. 2017, 2018, top scored 687 runs. In 2019, he was at Cook levels, 774 yeah. runs. I don't know how we drew that series 2-2 with him scoring all those runs, to be honest with you. He's genuinely, I think if he survives like the first three or four overs, he's like virtually impossible to get out.
Yeah. His average has actually taken a bit of a nosedive in the Ashes as well.
Oh, really?
Down to 55 in the past three or four series. He was, at one point, he was over 65 in the Ashes.
He went like a peculiarly long time without scoring 100.
Relatively.
But I mean, he's got 10,496 runs and counting, 36 tons and counting, 13th on the all-time list.
I feel like 2019 as well was a big moment, sort of obviously on the back of everything that had happened. He got booed very heavily at the start of that series in England. Yeah, that was a series that he got Jofra hit him and concussion.
That's how Labuschagne got his debut.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was a concussion sub, wasn't he?
Yeah,
he come into that game and then also got hit
in the head immediately by Archer.
But then he ended up getting standing ovation by the end in that 2019 series. I think the English view on him has softened. I think it's gone a similar way to Ponting. He's not exactly the guy we love to hate anymore.
It is pantomime, isn't it? The booing is pantomime. I heard recently, in fact, I think after the first test or just before the first test of this series, I think Darren Layman, who was his captain at the time of the Bulls tampering scandal. Basically said, like, you know, like, England fans are stupid, pathetic, they need to sort of get over it, like, just forget about it. Which I actually think is overly simplistic. That's not how it works, right? Like, if you cock up like that, then it will always be a blot on your paper, so to speak, because there are people who haven't done that. Therefore, it is a distinguishing feature. So I don't think people will forget it. But I also, like I said, like I thought it was a grossly disproportionate ban. And like, who hasn't skimmed the line, you know?
Well, we've talked about plenty of people who have.
Yeah, yeah. Like, and you know, is it like, it's like cheating, but it's not it's not doping. Like, you just sort of, I don't know, mate. Like, it's not the scandal it was made out to be. It was something that merited punishment and merited some sort of, like, you know, short ban. But, like, it's not a year out of the game, stripped of the captaincy, you know, vilified. But I also think that Darren Lehman just being like, I don't ever talk about it again is a bit like, well, it's always going to be talked about, mate.
Always.
Yeah, like...
Forevermore.
So, yes, but I agree with you. That's a very long-winded way of saying I think he is just a pantomime villain who everybody now respects and acknowledges has a supreme talent.
I mean, he's the best Australian batsman since Don Bradman, and that's all you need to say.
Yeah, for sure. So number four is Steve Smith. It's
not even a debate.
Steve Smith, number four. So who are you going at five?
It's a difficult one, five. And it is. As soon as I won the toss and chose to bat, I knew this was coming up in my head, because there's two people, I think. Well, you could give a nod to a couple of people who are sort of there or thereabouts around the sidelines. Kevin Peterson obviously being the one there or thereabouts, but I'm not, it won't be him, because it's either going to be Steve Waugh or it's going to be Joe Root. Now, Joe Root is, you've got the test statistics in front of you, I've got the Ashes statistics in front of me. Your picture will paint a lot better, it paints a lot better picture of Joe Root from his entire test career than it does the Ashes. And it's not to say that he's not been excellent in the Ashes. He has been at times. He's been absolutely dominant at times. Brilliant, wonderful, fantastic. But it's always going to be a question mark over him until he does it in Australia.
I don't like it, mate.
I know you don't like it, but is it not true?
I don't think it is. I genuinely don't think it is. And can I make the case for why it's not?
You make... Hey, this is we've been too in agreement so far, so you go ahead.
You cannot amass 13,551 runs, be sitting second on the all-time list, ahead of the likes of Ponting, Smith, Cook, who we've already mentioned, like, having racked up 39 test tons, 66 50s, like, done it everywhere, averaging 50, highest score of 262, and still going, and someone, just because you haven't scored 100, bearing in mind this man scored 90s, 70s, like plenty of 50s in Australia, just because he hasn't got a ton, they sit there saying, oh, you haven't.
It's like, symbolic. Completely symbolic.
Do you know what I mean? It's make-believe, it's fairy dust as like a measure of his talent and his ability and his merit or his worthiness of a position in an all-time 11. Like, Joe Root is, he could be statistically the best of all time by the end of his career. Time will tell. Like, anyone running this nonsense about him not having scored a ton in Australia, I find it boring.
I do too. I mean, he's had some incredible series at home, obviously.
Yeah,
he scored some brilliant centuries, a couple of centuries in 2015 that were key in Cardiff and Nottingham. 57.5 he averaged in that series, which is an obscene. Like, him and Stuart Broad between them won that series, you could argue. And yeah, he's been okay in Australia. He's averaged in the high 30s sometimes. His overall average, in fact, yeah, I think he did 47 in 2017 in a series that England got spanked in, probably arguably one of England's bright lights from that series. His overall average is about 40 in the Ashes, obviously less than his test average. That is obviously pulled down slightly by Australia, although, as I say, he has done well there. The only argument I would make, if we are arguing between Waugh and Root, we can't argue about this on the basis of Joe Root alone.
You want to make the case for Steve Waugh?
I want to make the case for Steve Waugh.
Yeah, let's hear it, because I've got a soft spot for Steve Waugh.
So this is, it's a strange one, because we are talking about, another argument you can make here is we're talking about within our lifetime, the last 30 years, and a lot of this information with Steve Waugh is obviously precedes that. It precedes, he made his Ashes debut, I think, 1986, before we were even born. Incredible longevity, 45 matches played in the Ashes, which I think is a record, certainly a record recently from my list, so I imagine it probably is. He averaged 58.75 in the Ashes. He scored 3,173 runs, 177 top score, 10 centuries, 14 50s. Those numbers are ridiculous.
Mate, the numbers are delicious. The numbers are delicious.
But were the England bowlers of the 90s as good as Stuart Broad and James Anderson and Simon Jones at his peak? And
the answer to that question
not Ashley Giles so much.
Is no.
No. No, I mean, England had a very... England didn't have a Stuart Broad and a Jimmy Anderson leading the line for decade, more than a decade together. Like, Darren Goff was... Good bowler. Got Ashes hat-trick. Very good player. Angus Fraser. Dean Headley. Like, Dean Headley had a good short Ashes career at the end of the 90s, but there's no consistency. There's no, like... The only England bowler you can pull off from the 90s
who could bowl spells occasionally, but you had nobody that you would sort of fear, right? You got someone on the wrong day, they could get you and they could have a day out, but like we didn't have anybody that would, well, clearly that would win you like test matches and series. So it's not the same.
Indeed. It is, I don't know, is the answer to this. I think it's hard to leave Steve Waugh out with those numbers.
Oh, I mean, also, let's not forget his test captaincy record, which is 41 victories, win ratio of 72%. That makes him the most successful test captain in history. 15. He led them to Australia to 15 of their 16 consecutive test wins, that world record. Got to make tough decisions here. He did top score in the 98-99 series, 498. He's also 60 years old, which I found really upsetting.
It's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And still 2 minutes older than his brother.
Look, he's so good that his brother couldn't escape a shadow, so much so that when Mark asked Englishman James Ormond, "What are you doing out here, mate?" he replied... Mark Waugh then saying, "There's no way you're good enough to play for England." And James Ormond replied, "Yeah, maybe not, but at least I'm the best player in my own family."
There's actually a third Waugh brother who played one single first-class game. Imagine what it's like to be him.
Like the Mannings.
Yeah, yeah.
Like car salesman and three rings. Yeah, Steve Waugh, mate. I mean... Can I say this about Joe Root in Australia to hopefully maybe settle this? Is the one thing that's often overlooked about Joe Root in Australia is throughout, he wasn't in the 2010-2011 team. I think he made his debut in 2012. I might be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure Joe Root didn't go to Australia in 2010-2011.
If he did, I've not got it written down, so I think he might be right.
Yeah, he didn't go.
2013 was his first year.
Yeah, so basically, in his career, he has been to Australia with an England side that has done this. Lost 5-0, lost 4-0, lost 4-0, and he's now going again. What does that mean, Jack? That means that Joe Root has basically been opening the batting for England in Australia.
That's a really, really good way of putting it.
Like, he's come in so many times in Australia where we're like 5-2, and if nobody if people are like, "Oh, you're just making excuses for him," and I know it's a very small sample size, so you know, sue me, but like in the first test that we just watched, Steve Smith came in at 3 because Australia got an opening dilemma and really struggled. It's a different position, and you're up against the best bowlers with a new ball when they're fired up and they're energetic. It's a lot harder, which is the reason you put your best bat at 4. So, and it's reliant on your opening batsman. Their success to a certain extent is reliant on their opening batsman doing something. And we never do anything in Australia. So I think his record in Australia is distorted. That's my view. And I think that if he wasn't facing, you know, Mitchell Starc, Josh Hazlewood, Pat Cummins, Mitchell Johnson in his pomp, fired up, like, basically in the first 2 or 3 overs of every test match he plays down there, then his record might be slightly better.
I think that's fair.
So I want Root at 5, but I know it's not a unilateral decision. He's challenging Tendulkar, mate. Sachin Tendulkar.
I mean, are we doing this traditionally? Like, we can't we can't skip a 6 or whatever.
No, we need an all-rounder at 6 with a keeper.
I was going to say, because you could always get Joe Root to do a bit of bowling, get Steve Waugh to do a bit of bowling, get Steve Smith to do a bit of bowling.
Steve Waugh used to bowl until he got injured, right? I didn't know that about him.
Yeah. Oh, obviously make Alistair Cook do a bit of bowling, test bowling average of 7, which is incredible.
Yeah, wild stuff. Who did he get? Ishan Sharma Was it
nibble
him?
Down the leg side, yeah. Terrible bowler. Terrible bowler.
Yeah, yeah.
It's described as right arm slow.
I would say, I know maybe it's coming through the lens of bias, but I would say Joe Root, because I think Steve Smith and Joe Root are 4 and 5. Also, actually, this is a statistic I should have brought out earlier. Joe Root, amazingly, he averages 67 batting 5. Now, he's only played 25% of his tests there, fair enough, albeit early on as well. But that bat him at 5 behind Steve Smith. You'll never get into the tail.
I think this might just be me justifying this, but I think if you swap Steve Waugh, the bowlers he's bowling against, with Joe Root, the bowlers he was facing, I think certainly it's not going to be a 58-40 split. It would be at least very much closer together. So sod it. Let's put Joe Root in and we'll take the flack.
Come
on, Australians, come at us.
All right then. So number 6.
I think that's the captaincy decided anyway, if Steve Waugh's not in it.
Yes, it is. That means Punter will be captain for sure. 6, are we playing all-rounder at 6 or keeper?
I think we're playing an all-rounder at 6. I'm just going to change my background.
To your nomination.
On our conversation for no reason.
To your nomination.
No, it's your nomination. I'm not trying to influence
Is that our nomination?
It's one of 2.
Jack, for everybody who cannot see what he's doing, which is everyone, he's putting up pictures of major Ashes moments in his background as we have this conversation, and he's just flitting through them at appropriate times. And right now he has a picture of Ben Stokes celebrating the Test match victory at Headingley in 2019, which is very appropriate considering I too am going to make the case that it is Ben Stokes. 57th highest run scorer in Tests, which is a lot higher than I thought. Not the best average in the world, 35, but
he is an all-rounder.
Sod the average. Look, like, is that, firstly, is there anyone else that comes close in terms of these all round capabilities? The man can produce miracles, like actual miracles. And obviously, everyone talks about 2019 at Headingley, predominantly because it's the best Test match innings that's ever been played, but also like because it's obviously an Ashes achievement, I guess. He's also got an Ashes ton in the Wacker in a losing cause, got 120. Have a look at the state of that pitch, mate, in 2013-14 at the Wacker. It's got like canyons in it. And Mitchell Johnson is like, that was when he was frothing at the mouth. And Stokes goes and gets 120. Like, what he offers in the field, that catch off broad at Trent Bridge in 2015 in the fourth test. Oh, God. Like, 235 test wickets at 31. Pretty decent economy at 3. Or just over 3. Like, economy meaning the number of runs people score off him per over, so not many. Yeah, like, I just think he's the package, mate. And he can do stuff. Like, he can dig in and, like, hang around when you need him to. He can go ballistic when you need him to.
Yeah.
Obviously,
he take key wickets when you need him to as well.
I mean, the 5 in the first test, need we say any more? Fastest Michelle, like you said.
Well, fastest Michelle other than
Stuart Broad.
Yeah, who's got a couple faster.
So
one of which I'm sure we will mention soon.
Oh, we will. yeah, look, I think it's Stokes. Who are the people that are competing with him? The obvious
there's
one
only
is
one.
Flintoff.
Flintoff, I think, is the only one. Australia don't, well, they never really had a proper all-rounder.
This is true.
Generally speaking, and obviously in the modern age, the line between lower order bowlers who bat in the lower order and all-rounders is getting thinner. I mean, there's a lot of good bowlers who can bat in their high 20s, but Flintoff, the thing about Flintoff, is he a better player overall than Stokes? Probably not. Certainly more injury-prone. Is he more talented than Ben Stokes? Probably. I would say, not that Stokes isn't talented, but Flintoff's, he had magic to him. Like, he was obviously, he was a character, a hell of a character. His TV appearances since pay homage to that. He is responsible for some unbelievably magic moments of our cricket watching days, that over against Ricky Ponting, where he just had him on the ropes.
Langer and Ponting at Edgbaston, where he gets Langer and then Ponting comes out. Yeah, God.
Yeah.
And then there's a front foot no ball, isn't there? And he gets him with the last ball of the over.
Yeah.
Ugh, beautiful stuff.
It's just that sort of sustained. I mean, he's proper fast bowler at his best when he was fit, which he wasn't always, when he was playing to his high capabilities, bowling the ball as fast as he could, can from the height he was bowling from, with the level of aggression. He was a superb bowler. Mm. And then he had, with the bat as well, he had the ability to score some magnificent, not just necessarily centuries, but score really quickly in really key moments as well. And
yeah, 2005, yeah. He got a ton, I think. I mean, he was a national hero in 2005, mate. Like,
it was a man of the series, yeah.
Yeah. And
it was, I mean,
also a gent.
Edgbaston 2005 was his moment, his test match. He got 68 off 62, which turned a 187 for 5 into 407, which basically won the match. Bear in mind how tight that series was, the series as well. And then, as we say, that Langer and Ponting reverse swing, high pace, just the best over
hostile
of the
stuff,
series.
Wasn't it?
One of the best overs I've ever seen. Incredible.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, as you were saying, and a nice bloke as well.
Yeah, I mean, what I was going to say, like, that's not even taken out of context. That's not just like, oh, you know, Freddie Flintoff's a nice guy. Like, that image of him consoling Brett Lee at Edgbaston, that's like one of the most enduring images, like, of the Ashes ever,
in
really.
Cricket, ever.
Yeah, like, it's beautiful stuff. Like, everyone, it's pandemonium. We, like, yeah. And he, first thing he thought to do was go over and shake an opposition player's hand. Like, that's high class.
It's, you can't coach that sort of thing. And if you could, you would, because that's what you want to see young sports people doing. It's what you want to see.
Because it doesn't come...
People doing that situation.
Doesn't come at the cost of his competitiveness, right? Like, that's what's so beautiful about it. He wasn't soft. Like, this guy was a winner, a terminator on the field. But he had the empathy and the wherewithal and the emotional intelligence to be like, you know what, this has been great, but, like, maybe that guy deserves a pat on the back here. And that's quality stuff.
And his cost in that situation was... He declined to go celebrate with his teammate in what was probably the best moment of his career, or what best moment of any of their careers, most unbelievable finish to an Ashes test any of them will have ever been involved in, because it's the most unbelievable finish to an Ashes test ever. And he went straight to a fellow bowler. Yeah, incredible.
Can I throw in one other name into the conversation?
I'm very interested to know who you're throwing in.
I don't think that it's going to change anything, because it would require our keeper to be to bat at six, really. But you could make the argument for Pat Cummings as a bowling all-rounder, because he averages 22 with the ball and also like an economy of 2.88. Like, he is a ridiculously good bowler. Underrated and still going. But he only averages 16 with the bat, and it's a long tail if he bats at
it
seven.
Is a long tail. I mean, I'm not going to get ahead of who we're going to be talking about. A couple of them can bat, but we're talking 17, 18 averages in their career, not you want someone 25, 26. Now, you can make the argument this team is so good that you could carry it with the top order, but I think I would say we'll save the Cummins debate, because I think we might come back to it. But for now, pick an actual all-rounder to keep with a sort of traditional lineup, as it were. Got to be Stokes.
That's fair enough, because what I was going to say, like, is the counter argument to my own debate, is Stokes gives you more. Stokes is not so much worse with the ball in hand that it offsets the shortfall in the batting talent. And then when you also add in the fact that Stokes is an absolutely electric fielder,
and a leader. He's a leader as well.
And a leader, potential captain, vice captain. I'm not saying we would make him captain. I think he's probably a bit too cavalier for this team. But yeah, you wouldn't mind being able to lean on him for a few ideas, right?
Exactly. Or a bit of a kick up the arse if needed.
Yeah.
To someone.
So we've got Stokes at six. I mean, let's put it this way. Our middle order is Smith, Root and Stokes, who are all still playing, which shows how high level, high quality some of the cricket that's being played is currently. Wicketkeeper batsman, number seven.
Adam Gilchrist, obviously. I mean, it's an absolute no-brainer. He's the best... he's one of the best two wicketkeeper batsmen ever live. Oh, I forgot about Boucher. Was Boucher that good a batter?
I don't know if he was. He was nowhere near Gilchrist level, but he was good.
Sangakkara.
Oh, Kumar. God, how could I forget? Oh, my goodness me. Goodness gracious, Kumar. Oh, God, I'm feeling things just at the mention of him.
And again, when I say to ever live, I do apologise to anyone whose knowledge of cricket history goes deeper than ours. Obviously, this is very much based on our lifetime. Adam Gilchrist, though. I never disliked Adam Gilchrist.
Sorry, mate. Throw me off here. I know this isn't a Kumar Sangakkara loving and we are talking the Ashes, but can we just be really crystal clear about something? Because I feel awful for having even overlooked him momentarily. The contest between Kumar Sangakkara and Adam Gilchrist as the best wicketkeeper batsman, that's not a conversation. Kumar Sangakkara is comfortably the greatest wicketkeeper batsman to ever play the game. So now that we've got that absolutely crystal clear.
Okay, so the second best, given that Kumar Sangakkara is neither Australian nor nor English, I should say. Definitely not Indian.
Sri Lankan.
Very much Sri Lankan, yeah. So Adam Gilchrist. I mean, he, generally speaking, pre-Gilchrist and even post-Gilchrist, your wicketkeeper, you could handle having someone who wasn't very good with the bat, essentially, because obviously you need a skilled glovesman or someone who's okay, someone who averaged in the 30s. And they tend to be more of a gritty kind of player who'd sort of dig out runs. What Gilchrist was is a very, very aggressive number seven. I mean, he opened the batting for Australia in one day internationals and did he even probably just about 20-20 matches towards the end of his career?
Maybe. He was extremely versatile anyway.
Yeah, he might have just about because his test career ended in 2007-2008. So that was about the time 2020 was starting. But regardless, very, very aggressive. Scored a lot of runs. He scored over 1,000 runs in the Ashes, as well as obviously lots of catches and stumpings to go along with that as a wicketkeeper. He averaged 45 with the bat, just over 45, including 300s in the Ashes, which is, you know, pretty darn good. 152 is his best score. He was a proper wicketkeeper batsman. A wicketkeeper batsman is a luxury. He was definitively, I mean, who did England have at that time? England went through
Alex
a few
Stewart
keepers.
Alex Stewart is probably...
Alex Stewart was a batsman wicketkeeper, not a wicketkeeper batsman. He wasn't very good at keeping. Not like Jack Russell. And I will give a quick shout out to Jack Russell because I love the guy. Brilliant glovesman for England in the early 90s. A little bit before my time. But I still remember... I remember having this affection for him. He must have been introduced to me while I was still a child. Like watching maybe county cricket, because it was probably after his England career ended when I started watching cricket. But yeah, Jack Russell's a character. He's now a painter. Very good painter, actually. I'd advise you look up both his glove skills and his painting skills. But I digress. It was just an opportunity for me to talk about Jack Russell. Stewart took over from Russell as England keeper, and it was nowhere near as good a gloveman as Russell. I mean, Russell was outstanding, but Stewart would have got in the team, and indeed did get in the team for on the strength of his batting alone, yeah. But yeah, I mean, Gilchrist was a class above.
He averaged 39 at tests. Yeah, Gilchrist is a class above. He is the standout candidate. I mean, Stewart averaged 39. Johnny Bairstow, he averaged 36. He's probably... Those two are probably the closest they've ever...
Didn't make the most of his talent, I don't think, Bairstow.
No. I mean, they pale into insignificance when it comes to Adam Gilchrist, though. I mean, Gilchrist averaged... Again, like context, I think is important in cricket. It often gets overlooked because your ability to score runs or contribute to a team is always circumstance dependent. And as you say, he batted seven in a very good Australian side, averaged 47 nonetheless. Like he could bat 6 to 8. His average didn't change at any of those positions. Ultra consistent, always coming up trumps for the team when required. He also because he batted so low down the order as well, like. It just means you bat in fewer innings, but you still make those contributions. I don't think it's a debate, is it?
Well, he once his 152, which was his best Ashes score, was off 143 balls, which is pretty rapid, especially at the time. It included taking 22 runs in a single over off Mark Butcher, who, to be fair, was a part-time bowler. A steady medium pace. Actually, not bad average. 37 average, I think. Somewhere around there in Test cricket. So not bad, but... It was at a time where England had basically already lost the match, and it was just cruelty personified.
Yeah, yeah.
But what a player.
And before we move on, if anyone wants to pay homage just to pure glovesman, then Ben Folkes.
Yeah.
What a wicketkeeper that man is. If he was just a slightly more explosive batsman or consistent with the bat, he would definitely be England's keeper. But the brand requires us to go big.
Indeed.
And Jamie Smith's very talented, so.
But he is, yeah.
Gilchrist.
He's looking good so far.
Gilchrist is a no-brainer. Okay, now we're getting into the business end. The firepower, the wizardry. Number eight.
I can see it in your eyes. How much you want to talk about this man.
Shane Warne, man. Like, he's my number one. I don't care for. Statistically second on the all-time list, but the only man to go beyond him throws it. So,
yeah, but Muralitharan also played most of his cricket in the subcontinent, generally speaking, which obviously they make the pitches spinner friendly. And I'm not criticizing. He was a brilliant bowler, and you're getting controversial by calling Wichuka. There's arguments to be made. But
the action was tested a couple of times. That's all I'm going to say. Shane's wasn't.
Shane Warne in England was as good as Shane Warne in Australia, was as good as Shane Warne anywhere. Yeah. And to do so with a personality like he had and as beloved as he had and controversial at times. And I mean, you go ahead. I'm making myself emotional.
Yeah, I mean, mate, like if just hearing like the phrase bold Warney or bowling Shane, like it's like etched into my mind, you know, like I shouldn't like it, but I do.
We used to shout at each other.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like a couple of English lads playing garden cricket, like in your teenage years, just imitating your biggest arch nemesis. Like, there isn't a bigger compliment that you can pay a sportsman, I don't think. Like, absolute homage.
Well, there's one I would say. It's that halfway through his career. He'd been playing for about 6 years at this point. He was to play for 7 or 8 years more. At a test cricket level, he carried on playing shorter forms of the game for longer. But less than halfway through his career, Wisden named him one of the five cricketers of the century. For the 20th century.
That's mental.
And he hadn't even finished his career at this point. And he was the only one still playing at the time and the only one who was a bowler, or specialist bowler, I should say. I think Gary Sobers was in the list. But yeah, that's homage.
Mate, he's so good. Like 145 tests, 708 wickets, second on the all-time list. Like, played 36 Ashes tests, I think. 195 wickets against England at 23, 4-10 wickets in a match, and one at the Gabba in 94, but three of those 10 wickets in a game came away from home, including in 2001, but two of them in 2005 in losing causes. So like, talk about having to beat the best in 2005. Like, this guy, just a magnificent.
So much better than any spinner England has ever produced.
Like, he's so much better than any spinner anyone's ever produced. He's just the fiercest competitor, but like the most lovable personality. Obviously struggled with his discipline on and off the field sometimes, but like
you can say that again. Let's not gloss over some of the things that he was accused of and did.
He just, yeah, he
got suspicious money floating around off bookies and potential failed drugs tests and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is stuff we'd criticize anyone else for to the nth degree, but I don't know.
That's
it. He's better than that.
That's it. It felt like how to articulate this in a way that justifies the man. If you were disappointed rather than upset because you knew he didn't need to.
Yeah.
Like when other people, like, you know, cheat at the game, whether that's, you know, taking drugs or, you know, trying to gain an advantage by some other means, you're like, you can almost sometimes forgive them because they're sort of trying to compensate for a lack of something. Whereas like Shane Warne, I feel like he did it maybe because he was bored or because he just had like questionable judgment or something.
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Like just have a bit of a laugh or like, you know.
I should say with the drugs, he did have a excuse that was largely accepted. But
even that, like, you feel like if he was taking like diuretics or whatever or weight loss drugs, it was probably because he couldn't be bothered to train. Like, it's not because he
was always a bit chubby.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I don't know.
Well, not always, actually.
You don't want to make excuses.
Slimmed off towards the end
for people, but Christ, like whenever he got it wrong, you were always just a bit disappointed because he was such a hero and you put him on such a pedestal because he had superhuman ability. And you just thought, why are you doing this? Like, the only person you're harming here is yourself, because the rest of us adore you. Yeah, like, mate, he fittingly retired in 2006-2007, the home series, when they walloped us 5-0.
Did he take the last wicket as well?
He definitely got... He went past a milestone. It might have been his 700th wicket or something. Maybe he got the last wicket. I can't remember. But he took 23 wickets in the series.
Yeah, and he finished on 708, was it?
Yeah, that's it.
Test wickets.
Let me verify that. I think that is correct.
I mean, while you're doing that, it goes without saying that he is. I've got a list of all the relevant players here. So the past 30 years, he is comfortably the highest wicket taker in the Ashes, ahead of Glenn McGrath in second.
Mm. He's got a heap of them, 195 of them. So
195. And should we talk about his first?
Christ
his
alive.
His first ball.
What a delivery.
In fact, was his first Ashes series or his first Ashes series in England?
Oh, good question. Not. Definitely first in England.
First ball in England, let's talk about.
Fuck me. Gatting
he was
as
bowling
well.
against Mike Gatting, who is a stalwart of the England team, elder statesman of the England team, a brilliant, intelligent batter, and Shane Warne produced what is regarded as correctly as the ball of the century. It pitched a mile outside leg stump, spun back and hit the top of off stump. And the look on Mike Gatting's face said it all.
Yeah, like, bamboozled is the right.
Absolutely.
The one detail that I always think is overlooked with the ball of the century is the drift. The drift doesn't get spoken about enough. Drift is when the ball, well, as it sounds, I guess, drifts in the air.
Because it's turning so much.
Because it's spinning. Yeah, exactly. And it's not quite swing. It's sort of difficult to explain. It sort of softly moves as Shane Warne's right-handed. It would have been moving sort of towards Mike Gatting's legs in the air, making him think that it was the trajectory of the ball, if it were to bounce straight, would go past his legs. Obviously he knows it's not going to bounce straight, it's going to turn off the pitch, but Shane Warne was a wrist spinner, which is a very difficult skill. It's particularly a very difficult skill to be accurate with, and it just rags, mate, off the pitch.
I think that's a brilliant ball. I think it probably is his best ball ever. I think the one where he gets Strauss was just as good.
Is it when he's leaving outside the off stump when he tries to pad it away?
And it goes behind his legs.
Andrew
Strauss is a left-hander batter, whereas Gatting was right-handed. So it's sort of the opposite way around, but sort of hits the same stump. But Andrew Strauss basically takes a big step forward, thinking the ball's going to go outside his pad. And if it turned in, it would hit his pad. So as long as it hits him outside the line, he can't be LBW. The ball spanned so much, it basically went behind his legs and bowled him around his eyes. Just incredible.
Yeah. And if you want some fun, like, because Shane Warne was a funny guy, a lot of personality, when like the Big Bash started and like the IPO and stuff, it was sort of the back end of his career and he played in it, and they obviously mic up the players, so you can hear him talking to the commentators as he's bowling, and in like one of the games he's basically saying how he's going to get someone out and then proceeds to do it. And it's a thing of beauty.
He used to plan, like he used to treat sort of like each over as like a sort of a mini step towards getting someone out. He'd like plan 3 or 4 overs ahead. He'd do this over, this, that over, make them think this, make them think that, and then he'd get them out.
Mm.
And he would.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, after retirement, he became a cricket commentator because he's, you know,
brilliant commentator,
such a great tactician, so informative, and just a real personality. Poisonous tongue occasionally. poisonous or funny, depends on how you view sledging, but I'm a big fan. Two of my favourites, calling Ian Bell the Shermanator from the American Pie series, is excellent work.
It's fair, to be fair.
And then saying to Paul Collingwood, you got an MBE, right, for scoring 7 at the Oval. That's embarrassing. with reference to the England team getting MBEs after the 2005 victory.
Yeah, Collingwood only played, was it the 5th test? Was Jones injured, maybe? Anyway, he played one test.
Yeah. And there's also, if you want a bit of fun from his commentating days, look up the clip of him talking to Mark Nicholas when David Warner's on like 97 against South Africa, and Mark Nicholas says Warner's never been out in the 90s. Shane Warne is very unhappy with him about it, because then David Warner immediately nicks off to Dale Steyn or someone. Shane Warne is one unhappy chap, but it's very amusing. So go have a look at those. But yeah, like could bat as well, Shane.
Yeah,
like,
it wasn't just to, wasn't bad
to get us back on track so that we can get through the tail here. The average 19 with the bat, 12 50s to his name, but no test match tons. I think he got 90 odd against England and then stepped on his stumps.
He did, yeah.
Yeah, which is, like, with the benefit of hindsight, is heartbreaking. At the time, I was probably cock-a-hoop. But, but yeah.
He did get a couple of first-class centuries, I think, when he was playing for Hampshire. So, yeah, he was good bat.
Felt the feeling. That's the main thing. So, yeah, look, number 8 is Warnie, the greatest.
And beloved by Varmy Army as well, especially by the end.
2005.
We wish you were English. We only wish you were English.
Yeah, yeah. 2005. That's the image that you've got on the backdrop now, is him doffing his cap to.
I'll stick some of these images up, the socials. But yeah, he's the best.
He is the best.
To give the story its sad ending for those who aren't aware, in 2022 in Thailand, he had a heart attack and didn't make it, sadly, which is heartbreaking.
Literally is heartbreaking. So let's not dwell on that, at risk of becoming emotional.
No, let's not. Is it my turn?
It is your turn. Number 9.
To talk about Stuart Broad. Because this is a no-brainer as well.
The next three positions probably pick themselves.
Well, we'll see. But yeah, we'll see. Certainly this one.
This one. I know the one you're going to debate, which I think is controversial. But
well, let's have a debate. Yeah, we might not come to a conclusion, but let's have a debate. Stuart Broad, though, batting 9, he is a decent batter, but what he was best at in the Ashes, well, what he was best at in cricket was in the Ashes, spells of incredibly destructive, dominant bowling, which is the kind of thing where if you're checking on your phone, and I was for one of these famously, not famously, me checking on my phone case, but one of these famous ones.
Yes. Trent Bridge.
You just refresh. Trent Bridge, yeah. You just refresh and it's just like, bowl broad. Caught behind broad, whatever it might be. Well, probably caught someone bowl broad. 8 for 15 at Trent Bridge. 2015,
seven,
I was...
7 for 15.
8 for 15.
Was it? He got 8? Yeah. I don't know why I thought it was 7. Who did I forget?
Let me double check. I think it was 8. Doesn't matter. It was incredible. And bowled Australia out for 60, I think, in that. The famous image of Can't Believe Your Eyes, the Specsavers advert. You'll have to see that. But I was at my grandparents' house, and it was one of the last days I think I was there. Was my nan died a couple of years after that.
You were right.
With my family.
8 for 15 off 9.3 overs. Sorry, Jim. Yeah.
I was there with my cousins and I was just refreshing and telling them the score and we were just losing our heads over it. It was a lovely moment, and there's obviously a famous image of him wheeling away, covering his mouth, which I've now changed to my backdrop for your benefit, Ben.
Yeah, that catch.
The best test figures ever at Trent Bridge. The fastest 5-4 in test history. Fastest 5-4 in test history joint. And basically settled the Ashes in a session. Incredible. And it wasn't the only time he did that. Obviously, he made David Warner look stupid on many, many occasions.
It's David Warner's daddy.
Yeah. He was David Warner's daddy. As soon as he worked out that bowling round the wickets to David Warner was a vulnerability for him, he just did it over and over again.
Yeah.
2019, he removed him 7 times during the series. And bear in mind, the most you can possibly dismiss someone in a series is 10. Pretty good strike rate.
Yeah, it's not bad. Oh, yeah, Broady, mate. Like, he's an Ashes icon.
He is. Absolutely. And, I mean, he hit a 6 off the last ball he ever faced in Test cricket, and he took the final.
I was there.
Oh, God, you were, weren't you? I hate you so much.
Yeah. It was beautiful.
And then, took the final wicket of the match and the series, Alex Carey, to win the Test in 2023.
After changing the bail again.
Incredible.
Do you remember that when he picked up the bail?
That was
fun. Like, I mean, it's absolute nonsense, but like, that's what I mean about like him being a bit of an icon. You just do random shit and it takes a meaning that it obviously doesn't have, adds to your legend.
Yeah. And those weren't his last balls faced with the bat and last bowl in just Test cricket. He never played a game of cricket after that. That was his last ever game of cricket. fully retired.
Such a good way.
What a way to go. He's an icon. I think in hindsight as well, I can only appreciate how much it was. Because I think he played second fiddle in a lot of people's minds for a lot of years to James Anderson.
To Jimmy, yeah.
Yeah. Sir James Anderson, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Let's get these titles right.
Yeah.
Oh, mate.
But not in the Ashes.
Not in the Ashes. He had some other great spells. Oval 2009, he took 5 for 37. Chester Le Street in 2013, he took 5 for 60. Edgbaston in 2019, also, you know, that really great series, 5 for 86. Like,
yeah, he took eight fifers in the Ashes, which is more than anyone on my list other than a couple of Australians, one of which we've mentioned and one of which I'm pretty sure you're about to mention.
Yeah, and, well, like, he...
if not you, then me.
Yeah, well, for sure. Like his career is almost defined by, like, the battles with Australia in many ways. Like, he's...
He raised his game.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm trying to remember, like, what was... Even the nicking and not walking in 2013 at Trent Bridge as well, the first test.
He did nick it.
Oh, God, he nicked it.
Quite clearly.
He smashed it to the slip. That was beautiful. That gave me sort of Atherton vibes, though. Like when Atherton nicked off to Ian Healy and then they said, "I thought you Poms always fucking walked." And he said, "When in Rome, dear boy." Beautiful. I think it was the Ian Healy he nicked off to. But anyway.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, look, Brodie's obviously going in there. He's just so damn good. You know, when in that 8 for 15, which you were quite right, again, like the Kuma incident, I don't know how I've forgotten that it was 8, but he also took his 300th test match wicket in that spell.
Yeah.
And they were bowled out. Australia were bowled out inside 19 overs. And it was Adam Vogues who Stokes caught at fifth slip. He was, that's the, oh, there we go, Jack. We were debating. When does a slip become a gully? Turns out they don't. Fifth slip. That's a gully all day.
Sixth, seventh slip. Yeah. Eighth slip.
Stokes is in the gully all day if you don't have, like, fourth slip.
It just depends on who's outside you.
Yeah.
I think gully is just last slip.
Just last slip. That's a nice way of putting it.
When you've got, like, 5. 6, maybe, it turns out.
Yeah. But, yeah, I just... Listening to him talk now, I went to a great cricketer podcast live show where he was interviewed, and it was a really good interview. I mean, their show is incredible, those guys, anyway. And now he's got his own one, and, like, he's obviously a Sky Sports commentator, and there's a meme doing the rounds of him being very upset at the England batting collapse in the second innings of the first test. But he's a really engaging speaker, like all these guys that have got, like, a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge and a confidence to sort of hold a room. I'm sure he's gonna have a long career now in broadcasting.
Yeah, and he's earned it.
He was a really good bat as well for the first half of his career. He averaged 18 by the end of his career.
Like, only... he took a hit to the face, didn't he?
Yeah,
around 2014, Pakistan.
Varun Aaron, I think it was India, wasn't it?
Was it India?
Yeah.
Well, either way.
I've been wrong a few times on this episode, so I might be misremembering again. But the ball went through the grill and hit him in the nose. And I think it might have even broke his nose. And it really, like, shook him, as you might imagine. But he has a test century, which was against Pakistan.
Which was, I think that was what I was thinking of. Yeah, it was 2014. The other one, it wasn't. I haven't got written down who it was, but yeah. It may well have been India. But yeah, 169 against Pakistan.
Yeah.
It's not a small knock.
No.
Not just... Didn't just 101 it, yeah, 169.
Yeah. 13 50s as well. And assuming that the two candidates, there's two standout candidates, are the two that I think that we're probably going to end up debating with, whoever you want to throw into the mix, he'll probably be the only person in our tail with a test match ton.
I suspect so, although, of course, Shane Warne, 99.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, Stuart Broad at 9. Go on, then.
It's you.
Is it me?
10 is you.
Well,
yeah.
I want Jimmy, and you're saying no.
I'm not saying no. I'm saying let's look at what the statistics show and have the debate over this. Now, in terms of wickets taken, James Anderson, Sir James Anderson, is fourth on the list in this period, in the past 30 years, behind Shane Warne, Glenn McGrath, who we will come to, Stuart Broad, and then him. However, he's played 39 matches, 117 wickets. There's a man who has taken 91 wickets in only 19 matches. And the question is whether, and a much better average too, average of 24.1 playing, Jimmy's about 35, averaging on the whole. Pat Cummins is that other man. Is it too early I say, is it too early? Pat Cummins is not a young man.
Okay.
He lost a lot of his career to injury. He's a great leader. He's obviously
he's taken
plenty of wickets and been very destructive to England as well in that period as well. And he's obviously injured now. He will probably be coming back for the third test, I imagine, unless it's something I've not heard.
Do you know
what are we thinking?
He's look. I really rate Pat Cummins. I like him a lot. Hence why
he's a very likable man.
He is also a very likable man. I brought him up in the all rounder debate because he's not a terrible bat, and he bats, you know, 8 for Australia, I think.
Yeah, he's got 350s at Test match level.
Yeah, and so like I really like him. I think, and he is an absolute gun bowler. Do you know why I'm like hesitating? He's got less than half of Jimmy's Test wickets.
Yes.
Like, don't get me wrong, Pat Cummins is currently sitting on 309 Test wickets. That's up there with like Mornay Morkel, Brett Lee, Ishan Sharma, Mitchell Johnson, Trent Bolt, Bob Willis, Alan Donald, Kasia Rabada. They're all in touch.
Pretty damn good names, yeah.
Yeah, Fred Truman, Josh Hazlewood, the greatest cricketer to ever play the game, Jack Callis. Like, he's in, you know, do you know what I mean? Like, he's a great.
Yeah.
And he's sitting 37th overall. But Jimmy's got 704 Test match wickets. At an average of 26. And the average of 26, look, the average of Cummins is incredible. It's much better. It's 22. It's like McGrath levels. But Jimmy did it over, like, 20 years. And this is the thing that I think gets overlooked about statistics, is it's like, it's all very well and good saying, you know, you were electric at the pomp of your career. But if you took, an 8-year window of Jimmy's career, you could probably get that average down. Like, the longevity of it.
Yeah. And the question would be if, and maybe he will, if Pat Cummins played till the age that Jimmy retired at, which was what, 41, was it? Whatever it was. Played his last Ashes test in. Does that average go up a bit, and do they balance out a little bit? Although I imagine Cummins would still be ahead. I mean, as much as you make this argument about Cummins, you can make the argument about Mitch Stark as well, who's got a similar record.
Fuck me,
albeit
Mitchell
not
Stark's
quite as good.
Not
quite as good
spoken
an average.
About enough, though. Not spoken about enough. Like, an absolute athlete.
He's only got 10 wickets less, Mitch Stark, than Jimmy Anderson got in the Ashes in 16 less matches.
Mm.
So in terms of concentration, but then you could go even more concentrated than that and say Ryan Harris, because Ryan Harris only played 12 Ashes matches at an average of about 20, which of course we wouldn't talk about him, and we're not going to.
Just hold up. Let's stay calm here. We don't need to go off on wild tangent. We're talking about the greatest.
At what point does that line get crossed? I mean, 19 matches for Cummins, 23 matches for Stark, 39 matches for Anderson. Anderson averaging 35, strike rate of 73, playing strike rate in the 40s for Mitch and Pat.
Oh, Mitch is 17th overall, 412 Test wickets. Like, Stark is, he's a weapon.
Mm.
And when he castled fucking Rory Burns, God. Like, you just knew we're on a hiding to nothing. Like, first ball of the series.
At least we didn't get any false hope that year.
For sure. Leg stump, half volley, misses it, you know, knocked him over, I think was the commentary.
Indeed.
Unbelievable with the pink ball, which is ominous.
Very much so.
Because of this evening.
Yeah.
I think he's taken like 80 odd wickets with the pink ball. Nobody's taken more.
I think he is the most, I seem to recall reading. It's a debate. It's a debate, and I think you're basing it very much on test. And don't get me wrong, if this was based on test cricket as a whole, it's Jimmy every day, all day long.
I don't think Jimmy's...
But is it?
I don't think Jimmy's Ashes record is that bad. 87 wickets at 35, 4 or 5 wicket hauls, 110 for the match. The longevity, the professionalism, the skill set, the reliability, he's metronomic, mate.
Yeah.
He can also bat. Remember Cardiff 2009?
Are we really going to try and sell? Yeah, okay, fine. he cannot get out sometimes. In fact, he didn't get a duck for many, many years, did he? It was a long time before he got his first test duck.
Can I put it this way, okay? So I understand what you're saying. There are some very talented guys, which is why this is such a ruthless debate. But he is the greatest swing bowler ever, and this team would be going home and away.
Yeah.
And his record in Australia is not such a drop off. And you could always play Cummings in Australia. Do you know what I mean? We're not wedded to this 11.
You'd have them both in the squad for sure.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
probably Mitch Stark as well.
They're in the travelling party. maybe that's the actual answer. I really do find it difficult to believe that Jimmy Anderson doesn't start. But look, you're right.
It's a debate for a reason.
And he could play in. He's playing in England. Let's put it that way. He's playing in England. Test match 50 to his name. Averages 8 with the bat.
Don't try and sell him on his batting, especially not against Cummins.
Yeah, I know. But he's only going at like 2.8 economically in Australia, which is basically identical to England. So even if he's not picking up the wickets, you're not scoring runs off the man. And when you've got Glenn McGrath potentially coming in imagine those two are the new ball.
See, Mitch Stark's a pretty good batter as well. Didn't realize he was that good. He's got 99 as well to his name.
Yeah.
Yeah, hate to see it.
Anyway. Let's leave 10 there with Jimmy starting, but depending on conditions, a conversation.
That feels like a compromise, but I'm okay with it because we're now going to talk about 11, and 11's a no-brainer, and this will we're not going to piss any Australians off here, put it that way.
No, we're not. Go on, just wrap it up.
Glenn McGrath, of course.
Yeah. Should we leave it there?
I mean, nothing more really needs to be said. He's the best bowler I've ever seen in my life, best seam bowler, I should say, in terms of consistency, line and length. It, just like making a, being able to hit the top of off stump with that level of consistency and just getting it to move away, getting it to move in and just grinding down batsmen, but also taking wickets as a result of that. I mean, his Ashes, he took 157 wickets in the Ashes at 20.92, which is ridiculous, at a strike rate of 46. 10 fifers, which is only one less than Warne. Obviously got a few less wickets than Warne, but he did play less matches than Warne as well. Better average than Warne, although why am I comparing these two? They're both legends. They're both two of the best. Their careers basically went side by side, but for a year at the beginning. That 2006-2007 Ashes, where England got whitewashed, having won it 2 years earlier, or a year and a half earlier, was the swan song for both Warne and McGrath in the tests, as well as others. I think Langer as well bowed out there. It's just like, he's a likeable guy, even though he still understands and plays his part in the banter that goes back and forth between England and Australia. Of course, every time he gets asked what's the score in the Ashes going to be, he always predicts 5-0 to Australia, and that's fine. We're happy for that.
It would be the same if he didn't.
It would be wrong if he didn't.
Mr. Lyon Lengths,
mate. Such a smooth technique.
Yeah.
Relentless.
He's also huge. I didn't realise how tall he was.
He's a tall guy, yeah.
Yeah, he's 6'6" or 6'7".
No, he's not that tall.
Is he not 6'5"?
No, 6'3", I think.
I think he's
I'm going to check because you're making me second guess this. He doesn't look that big.
I know, that's what I mean. I think he is much bigger than you think.
Oh my word, he's 6'6".
Yeah, that's what I mean. He's huge.
Fair play. Well, you've literally proven your point.
He's
Pigeon, more nickname. Like, he's also 55, Ben.
That's scary. Probably the best seam bowler to ever live.
Oh, he's got a test 50. I'm impressed by that. 61's his top score because he was not a good batter. Not a good batsman at all.
No, he's not a good batsman. He is England's tormentor in chief is what he is.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like, just, oh, mate.
Like, he got 8 for 38 at Lords.
Can I put it in this?
1997.
Can I explain
to
this?
To introduce himself. Yeah, go ahead.
So, like, you and I are purists, I think, when it comes to sport. Like, you want to win on merit. You want to win clean. Like, we're not win-at-all-costs guys, basically. Like, if someone beats you because they're the better man and they play the better sport or the better woman, then so be it, is how we would...
Indeed, yeah.
Probably describe ourselves as fans. But I am ashamed to say that when he stood on that cricket ball in the second test, in the warm-up of the second test in 2005 at Edgbaston.
Changed history.
Having skittled us at Lords in the first test and we were 1-0 down, I was jacked. I have never, like, I am ashamed to say that was one of the few times I was delighted that an opposition player got injured. I'm glad it wasn't too serious and he was able to carry on, you know, like his career in swift order. But I have to say that we wouldn't have won that series if he hadn't got injured.
I don't think so, no. I think it was a history-changing moment and, just be happy for it.
Yeah. Also fittingly retired after the 5-0 demolition in 2006-2007, along with Warnie.
He did. Yeah. He did. And he was also famously, he was married to an English woman, Jane McGrath, who obviously sadly lost her life from breast cancer in 2008 and has done a great deal of fundraising since then for the McGrath Foundation, which obviously is a breast cancer support and education charity based in Australia. As we mentioned, the fourth test, is it? Is the pink test? Or was it the fifth test? SCG, isn't it? Fifth
SCG,
test.
SCG, the fifth one, yeah.
Of course, because it's a Sydney, he's from Sydney and it's a Sydney, well, he's from New South Wales anyway, but it's a Sydney-based charity. And raise a lot of money for a very good cause.
I think he was a big support to Andrew Strauss when his wife Ruth Strauss also died from a
rare form
of lung cancer. And I think he helped, or maybe he didn't help, I don't know, but he certainly was supportive of Strauss setting up the Ruth Strauss Foundation, and they do the Red for Ruth thing, which is on the second day of the Lord's test.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah,
which is like that's just you know, a cool thing.
Yeah, it's something people get involved in. I mean, the Barmy Army, England's travelling support, wear pink shirts during the pink test match. And yeah, it's a good thing, obviously.
Definitely.
On the back of a very sad tragedy.
Yeah. Is that a nice place to leave our 11?
Unless you want to pick a 12th man. I mean, captain, I think we already sort of agreed on the way as punter. Yeah. I mean, Cookie would be vice captain, but I couldn't see Cook captaining punter with punter as vice captain, but I can't see it the other way around, put it that way.
Yeah. Well, 12th man's obvious as well, mate. It's Gary Pratt. Oh,
of course it is, yeah. at least he's not gonna run punting out in this team.
Easy money. I mean, look, we could do this for hours and hours and hours. We haven't even like mentioned.
But we have almost.
Yeah. But we haven't even mentioned Atherton, Strauss, Triscothic, Khawaja. We barely mentioned Kevin Peterson. We didn't mention Michael Clark, which is absurd.
Michael Clark is a harsh one to not mention.
Very harsh.
We basically only mentioned Mark Waugh for being less good than his brother, even though he averages 50 in the Ashes.
Mike Hussey.
Not 58. Mike Hussey, 59
Thorpe.
Average in the Ashes, yeah, albeit only in a few tests. Graham Thorpe, of course, sadly departed Graham Thorpe.
Ian Bell, underrated.
Ian Bell was very good.
We mentioned him, take the piss out of him, but we didn't mention how good he was. Won the most.
Jonathan Trott,
yeah, good player.
Not many matches, unfortunately, but yeah.
No, short career, but excellent career. I mean, there are two Australian bowlers, which we haven't mentioned, which I think is nigh on unforgivable. Nathan Lyon.
Yeah.
And Brett Lee.
Oh, Brett Lee. I thought you were going to say Mitch.
Well,
did we mention Mitch?
I think Mitch came up a couple of times, but we didn't really give him his due, to be fair. Mm. He's also, right up there.
Brett Lee's a legend, part of that unbelievable lineup that somehow got beaten.
Yeah.
Slipped upon cricket ball, giving an assist to that.
Yeah. And from an England perspective, another English perspective that we haven't mentioned, like give him his due, even though he's had a slightly controversial or turbulent last few years to a certain extent, Michael Vaughan.
Yeah.
Serious player.
He was, and a good captain.
Very good captain.
Probably our best captain since, really, in terms of pure captaincy.
Mm. Yeah. So look, and we're probably missing.
Can I mention one more Australian, really random one? Stuart McGill.
Who took
39 Ashes wickets at 24 apiece, which is very good, including 3 fifers, but only played 6 tests because, of course, he was a leg spin bowler.
Yeah, and
at the same time as Shane Warne.
Yeah, that's a very cute number when it pales into significance.
He'd be a 400 test wicket player without Shane Warne, probably.
Look, then the breaks, as they say.
Yeah, it's all about timing.
It is, and the being behind the greatest of all time, well, there's no shame in that.
Not far from it.
Did Stuart McGill get into loads of trouble recently?
I don't know. I hope I haven't.
I swear.
Just called out someone.
Stuart McGill. Did he get done for drugs?
We've all been done for drugs once or twice in our lives.
I genuinely think that he's got himself in a
pickle. Yeah, you're right. In 2021, McGill was a victim of an alleged kidnapping in the Sydney suburb of Cremorne. In 2023, he was charged with a conspiracy to supply cocaine. In March 2025, a jury found McGill guilty of knowingly taking part in the supply of a prohibited drug. Legend. See, yeah. He's trying to out Shane Warne, Shane Warne.
Yeah, it's impossible.
Even to this day.
Yeah. And as these things tend to do, he's overcompensated massively. Warney never got into that kind of level of scandal.
No. You got to know where your limits are.
Right. I think that completes the Ashes trio, the hat trick of Ashes episodes. We might flirt with it in the new year.
We'll see.
MCG tests, SGG on New Year's Day as well.
As if we want to talk about it by then.
Yeah, yeah. But where we're gonna really change pace next week, I think. What are we doing?
Darts. We're doing darts. It's a very different sport. Again, a bit like the snooker we did right at the beginning. It's a very British sport, although becoming more international.
And we're gonna be asking the existential questions like, is darts a sport?
Is darts a sport? Well, and are darts players athletes?
Yeah.
I think we can answer that second one very quickly.
Come back to the Almanac to find out more next week.
Yeah, it'd be a nice different pace. I'm looking forward to that one.
Yeah, but that's been really fun. Here's to hoping, in all probability, by the time you listen to this, we're 2-0 down.
Probably, but also, you never know.
You never know. All right.
Could win at the Gabba in a day-night test. It's not going to happen, is it?
Sure. Right. See you next week, mate.
I'll see you next week. Have a good week. You know, I'm going to talk to you every day in the meantime.
Very much so. Bye.
Bye. Thank you, listener, old or new, for spending some time with us today. If you agree with our team selection, then click like, follow, or tell a friend about us. If not, then write us an angry comment, which we promise to reply to, and then like and follow us anyway, and tell a friend too. Life's too short to hold grudges, after all. Our theme tune is Oh Yeah by Harmony Productions. You can find us on Instagram and Blue Sky at The Sporting Almanac. Next up, it's that bastion of entertainment, darts, head of the PDC World Championships. But until then, with your team Jimmy or Pat, Tugger or Root, sport is nothing without the history that makes it. Goodbye.